Hello and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley and I'm the founder of Blogosphere. We run events, an influencer network, a magazine, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @BlogosphereM. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by Emily Trenouth, who is Head of Influencer Marketing Strategy at Mediacom. Emily started her career selling pension funds before starting her own blog, which led her into the world of influencers and influencer marketing. Before working at Mediacom, Emily worked at both Takumi and Tribe and saw the growth of micro-influencers firsthand. Now at Mediacom, she has a more 360 approach to influencer marketing and is seeing budgets continue to increase into the space.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm Emily, Emily Trenouth. I'm Head of Influencer Strategy at Mediacom.
And can we go back a bit in your career and tell me how you ended up in your role? Where have you been and how has influencer marketing been part of your career thus far?
My sort of entrance into the industry is very different from anyone else's. So I actually started my career in financial services. And I was working with financial advisors recommending different pension and investment funds, which sounds very, very different and very boring.
Was it boring?
It was, for me, it was quite interesting, actually. It was a very sort of high pressure sales role. I was traveling a lot, and it was great in terms of my sort of early stage career and really quickly learning those sort of really core business skills. So I found it quite interesting, but my mentor at the time actually said to me, don't take this the wrong way, but you're really interesting when you talk about the things that you love, but you're really boring when you talk about pensions. And I obviously thought, oh God, like, what am I doing? This is definitely not the right industry for me. And at that point, weirdly, I was sort of starting to become really heavily involved in a lot of, sort of women's networking groups in that sector. It was huge at the time.
Was this in London?
Yes. Yeah. And what I found was that a lot of the learnings were great for people who were in these networks, but there was so many people like myself, you know, when I first started my career, who had none of these sort of best practices and didn't have this information from all of these, you know, hugely successful people. So I actually launched a blog, which was just a little side project, and that was really to share best practice, and it kind of evolved into interviews and travel and different tips as to, you know, where women were going to, you know, for their R&R holidays and, you know, where they're going to have their digital detoxes and those kind of things.
And what year was this in?
This was, I believe, 2014, 2015.
Yeah.
So it was never, I never launched it with the goal of becoming a blogger or, you know, becoming an influencer, but it just very quickly became a huge passion of mine. And I started to really get invested in growing my social accounts. And yeah, that's really where it kind of piqued my interest. And at that point, I was sort of wondering, how can I transfer these skills that I've got from a business and commercial aspect into this world of social and digital? And obviously at that point, bloggers and influencers were starting to sort of come about.
Yeah, were you following anyone at that time? Or?
Yeah, I was. I was following a few people. And it was a friend of mine was friends with Josie London.
Yeah.
And she was telling me, I think they both started out their sort of career in retail together, I think. Don't quote me on that though. And she was sort of telling me how much money she'd been offered from a brand deal and quit her full-time job and she'd become an influencer. And that was in sort of really early days. And obviously now she's one of the key influencers that most brands are sort of chewing at the bit to work with. So it was that sort of interested me in a way. And yeah, so I don't really know how I came about it, but I stumbled across Takumi, which is an influencer platform.
So had you tried to go full-time then with your own?
No. So this was still a part-time thing, but it was very apparent that that was where all of my sort of efforts were going.
Yeah.
Career-wise, I was sort of in a bit of a rut where I was doing really well, but also I wasn't invested. And for me, I have to be invested fully and passionate about what I'm doing in order to succeed and thrive. So I'd stumbled across Takumi and they were looking for salespeople who didn't necessarily have experience, because at that point there wasn't really such a thing as experience in influencer marketing. But they wanted people who had good sales skills and who had an understanding of the industry. So after a few conversations with them, very quickly joined the team, and that was when they were quite early on. So I think they'd been going for about 6 months.
Oh, wow, yeah.
So it was very much early stage startup, kind of hustling from the ground up. Spent about a year there and loved my time there. But I actually read that Tribe were coming across to the UK from Australia. I read it in the press. And I'd heard about their model being content first, where influencers create content up front instead of going out and handpicking influencers one by one. And I just thought to myself, I've got to go all over this, because the market had been educated on micro influencers by the likes of me. Mm-hmm. And it was still very new in terms of micro. You know, when I first started at Takumi, people were, you know, not even willing to pay influencers. So I knew I had to get all over it. I had a couple of conversations with them and joined to launch the UK. We can probably go into a bit more detail on that later on.
Yeah.
Conscious of time.
What was... Oh, we've got plenty of time. What was... When you were at Takumi, just to go a little bit back, and lots of the brands saying that they didn't have any budget to pay influencers, but that was a paid model. So it was a lot of it kind of education around that. And how difficult was it to manage kind of supply and demand? Because you've got two sides to that business model. So you need enough influencers, but you need enough brands so that influencers are still getting work. Was that difficult to manage?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely with every tech model in the influencer space, there's this sort of equilibrium, and you need to manage that balance between brand demand and influencers. And there's definitely a balance, you know, those days the budgets were a lot smaller, you know, whereas nowadays if you're to fulfill a six-figure budget with micro influencers, you need to make sure that you've got those influencers ready to go. And that's something that either you can have existing on your network, which, you know, some established platforms will do, or you need to have a really robust growth strategy as to how you can acquire those influencers quickly. And I think that's the interesting thing about platforms is, you know, some people say sort of who's on your books or how many influencers have you got? And it really depends in terms of what the brand's needing. I think back in those early days, a lot of the key brands were very much in the sort of FMCG space, and any niche briefs were definitely more difficult to fulfill.
Yeah.
And that's just because the industry was quite new. Influencers, especially micro-influencers, were very new to how they work with brands. And Takumi's model actually goes from 1,000 followers, which means that, you know, technically it could be a sort of everyday person. Mm-hmm. And to educate them on how to accurately follow a brief in their own style can be quite difficult. So there was a bit of sort of to and fro with the influencers in terms of getting them to follow the briefs and educating them on how to work with brands.
But you noticed the budgets increasing during your time at both, and were the budgets predominantly coming from brand direct, or was it from agencies?
Bit of both, to be honest. I think from my time at Takumi, this is going back 3 or 4 years now, so yeah, don't quote me on this, but I think it was mostly brand direct and quite a few PR agencies. And for them, it was just, you know, how do we fulfill this in the most efficient way possible, because we're managing so much.
And they must have just only been starting to get actual budget, so smaller amounts.
Exactly. It was very small budgets, and it was just a lot easier and more efficient to work with influencers in that way. At Tribe, it was definitely a 50-50 split. There were a lot of brands who were doing it direct. And to be honest, it was all dependent on the resource. You know, some brands now have internal teams who are dedicated to this function. And the approach that I would always take when a client would ask, you know, who do we go through? Do we go direct to you, or do we loop in our agency? It's all dependent on the resource and the capabilities that you guys have, because you need to have a clear and robust strategy tied to it. And you can't go into an influencer campaign not having the resource to appropriately manage it. And yeah, so it was definitely a 50-50 split.
So you helped launch the Tribe UK kind of team.
Yeah.
So what did that look like? Kind of what was your time at Tribe like, and how did it evolve? And
crazy.
Yeah.
is how to sum it up in one word. It was amazing. So for me, it felt like having the experience of launching something your own, but with the backing and support of a business who was already semi-established. They'd been going for about 18 months before they launched in the UK, and raised a fair bit. And
was there funding from Australia when you joined, or had they funded?
I think mostly from Australia, and they'd got some investment from the UK, I believe.
Yeah.
At the point where they launched in the States, a lot of that came from the US as well.
So they launched in the US after the UK, or was it?
After the UK, yeah. So we launched the UK in early 2017, and yeah, it was absolutely hectic. We had myself and one other girl running around London, literally running between meetings, and it was great. You know, we did a huge launch strategy at a lot of the bigger events like Ad Week and Marketing Week. And I remember the pictures. Our founder, Jules Lund, who is an ex-TV and radio host in Australia, is this amazing presenter, and we kind of really capitalized on his skills. So he would do these incredible talks that were super inspiring, but also really subtly heroed the tribe model, which was all being content first. And obviously that's so unique in market that everyone wanted a bit of it. So we had this great sort of groundswell of positive anticipation around the launch, which was so, so fortunate that you know, you can only dream of. So
I think I went to that talk at Marketing Week, actually.
Oh, did you? Yeah. You're probably in the selfie. You got to take a selfie stick on stage. And yeah, so it was a hectic time.
What was the reception like from other people when you came into the market? Because there were platforms that existed, but the model was different. So I think did you ruffle a few feathers?
Yeah, I mean, well, I was the first one from Takumi to go to a competitor, so that obviously wasn't the easiest conversation to have. They were very respectful, though, as was I. I think in the early days, there were only a few key bigger players, so it was definitely more competitive, whereas I feel like now there's a lot of people doing a lot of different things, and you've got a few key people who have been around for a while. And they all seem to be doing quite a good thing, but kind of owning their own space. And Tribe has really carved out that definition of being content first, focusing on the content and the UGC aspect, and also being a self-serve model, which I don't believe anyone else is really doing.
Yeah. So with Tribe, would you say that it is an influencer platform, but influencer in more of a kind of loose term, because it could be really anyone and it's more about the content and people buying the content to put on their own channels, like the brand's channels, as opposed to the distribution and using that influencer's audience?
It's a bit of both, yeah. So I think their sort of strapline is all around unlocking the world's creativity. And what they really believe, which I also am really passionate about, is the fact that the world's advertising creative can actually be unlocked from the very consumers that it's designed to engage. So something that Jules and the team do a lot at big keynotes is they will ask everyone in the room to take out their phone and get up a piece of UGC that features a brand and send that into an email address. And some of the stuff that comes in is quite weird, but there's really great quality stuff in there. And that's in marketers' camera rolls, you know. And
I had to do that.
Amazing. I want to see what
I can't remember what I sent. Yeah, I have to go back.
And then what they do is in the middle of, you know, while Jules is doing his presentation or another member of the team, they then package that up and present it back in a billboard. So it's actually showcasing this is content that you're taking with your iPhone. And this is just a quick example of what can actually be produced. And you know, Jules says it's magazine quality and billboard size. And, you know, the Shot on iPhone campaign is really an example of that. And so they're really passionate around tapping into everyday creators and the fact that Instagram has a billion people who have converted into these photographers, and to actually convert into taking photographs and being comfortable sharing them is a really big thing. And it's obviously the world and the society that we live in now. And the fact that we're also at a point where, especially from a digital advertising point of view, brands really don't have enough content to fulfill the needs of social. So for them to be able to tap into this sort of ever-growing economy of everyday people who are creating this content all the time is where Tribe is sort of trying to be the technology connecting the two, whether that's posting on social and getting that word of mouth reach and engagement, or whether it's just licensing those assets and using them elsewhere.
It was quite difficult to leave then, I imagine, but you have done so. Why did you leave?
It was very difficult to leave. There were lots of tears, and I think a lot of people were very shocked in the industry. So, well, for full transparency, I went across to launch the US market and was heavily involved in that, both pre-launch and when we actually launched out there, or then they. I have a habit of saying we. And the whole plan was to move out there, and just really strict restrictions on visas at the moment in the US.
Oh.
Not through any fault of my own, just to clarify.
Yeah. No criminal record.
No, definitely no criminal record. But yes, it was just due to, I guess, there was not really...
You wanted a new challenge.
Yeah, there wasn't really a next step for me there. I think we'd grown the UK to a really good point, where at the point I left the UK team, I think they're responsible for over 50% of global revenue, which was huge. The US was really starting to take off, and I could have gone back to the UK, but I wasn't quite sure if that was my next step. And actually, when I was out in the States, Mediacom reached out to me and said, hey, we'd love to have a conversation. And it just felt really natural. It didn't really feel forced. I wasn't actively looking. But the more conversations I had with them, the more I thought, okay, this is a great opportunity.
What was it like going from kind of two startups to a legacy brand?
It's definitely a big challenge. It's something I'm still working through. I've only been at Mediacom for just over 3 months. And it's weird because I kind of started my career in a bigger corporate, to then going into startups and to then go back into a bigger corporate, but in the space that I'm interested in. So it's kind of a weird 360.
Have you found decision making is taking longer than it would do?
Massively. I think the great thing about Mediacom is we have really talented people, and we have great teams from a number of different perspectives, you know, from creative to research and insights, you know, where we can tap into measurement. And that's what excited me, is kind of unlocking this world, which I hadn't quite fully seen being at Tribe and Takumi, where you're sort of in your own bubble and you're dealing with, you know, the brand manager or the social media manager direct, but you're not seeing the bigger picture. So it's really interesting for me, but it's also just such a beast to navigate. So it's something I'm still working through. And what you sort of quickly realize is you can't be there for everyone.
Yeah.
But you definitely have to have a knack for identifying who those key people are that can help you make decisions quickly and get through to the right people quickly, so you can actually start to move a little bit faster. But it's definitely a longer process.
Do you find that you are now more involved with the kind of creativity and that side of like strategizing campaigns, and is that something that you're enjoying doing?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's weirdly, even though coming from tech, a lot of the clients I was working with were on more of a consultative approach. So P&G and Unilever in the States, my biggest clients, and the relationship with them was consulting on the strategy as well as the execution being through the platform.
Do you think Mediacom wanted to go more down a Tribe model and see creators more as kind of content production?
Or
want to increase that arm of it?
Absolutely. I think a bit of both. I wouldn't say a Tribe model from the sense of tech. I think that agency and tech are very different. But in terms of the content and the quality of content, that's what I'm really passionate about. And everyone in the agency agrees with the fact that influencer content just doesn't have to live on an influencer's own channel. And I think that's a really underutilized part of the industry, where so many brands don't even reshare an influencer post. And I'm like, someone's created this amazing branded content. Why wouldn't you, you know, repurpose that?
Do you see licensing is going to become a much bigger part of the...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what Philip Hughes, the COO of Gleam, was saying when we were interviewing. We've just started tapping into like the licensing of content.
Absolutely.
But are influencers being paid enough for that? And is that going to affect, you know, you talked about kind of Tribe and licensing that content, but influencers now are starting to be like, here's the content, but here's my price if you're going to license it, because the contracts have been so much in their infancy that, you know, I I think it was Lorna Lux was talking about a campaign that she did and suddenly her hand was on the back of Stylist. And although that's like, cool, that's my hand, but actually it's like,
Yeah, there definitely needs to be really tight parameters around it. I think you need to have different tiers of license, you know, where that can be used, and the brand needs to be really explicit around that. I think some people haven't quite got there yet. I think Tribe were very early in adopting a really robust approach. So they would offer brands different tiers of license, you know, whether it's digital usage only, whether it's digital and offline, where the creator can understand, actually, this could be in a billboard. You know, if you're comfortable with that, then accept the terms.
Would the influencer get paid more for that?
Yeah. So the license would always be on top. So they'd be paid for their, essentially their reach and engagement through the initial fee that they set in the platform. And that's if the brand chooses to work with them and they post their content. And then on top, the brand can request to license. So actually it sends through a request to the influencer where they have full terms and conditions of the terms of the license. They can sign off things like permission from other people in the shot. They can confirm that, say, it's an alcohol brand, everyone's over 25. I know they were fleshing it out as I was leaving, but some more parameters around if there's children in the image, just to make sure that everything is very watertight. So the influencer always has sign off on whether that can or can't be used anywhere else. And sometimes the influencers would decline. We had some examples where it was a picture from like her sister's wedding day, and it was around this Mother's Day campaign for a brand, and she just wasn't comfortable with selling and using that for someone to put in another channel. There was another one where her children were in the shot, and she wasn't very comfortable with that going anywhere beyond social. So the influencers always have the power to say no as well, which I think is really important.
Mm. And then I suppose a lot of brands are then licensing that content and putting paid media behind it. Do you think we're going to see more of that?
Absolutely. Yeah, Facebook are really heroing their branded content ads model, which is very smart from them. I think, you know, we've got to a point where we all know influencer marketing works. We all know it's not going anywhere. And it's worth, you know, billions of dollars. And essentially that those billions of dollars are all on Facebook's land. So the easiest way for Facebook to get involved in that from a revenue point of view is obviously to generate ad revenue. So it's very clever. You know, I don't know any official stats. My guess would be that they would reduce organic reach with paid partnerships posts. And then obviously they know that because it's a funded post, that the brand can pay to boost that, whether it's boosting amongst the influencer's audience or whether that's actually running that as an ad separately.
When clients are coming to you, is there a particular platform that they seem to be interested in working with influencers on? Do you get lots of briefs that are, you know, kind of YouTube first, or are you seeing a rise in brands wanting to use TikTok?
I would say that the majority is Instagram focused. I definitely think that seems to be across the board the most popular platform in the influencer space.
Why do you think that is, and do you think that's necessarily a good thing?
I think it's a good thing. I think, you know, we've also reached a point where we're all a bit fatigued with the amount of apps that we have. And for myself, I know that since Instagram launched Stories, I barely open Snapchat. And they're very smart at quickly adopting new features that they know people will love. But I think from a brand's perspective, they're only getting more and more sophisticated in terms of the measurement and ROI. So, you know, even just being able to have swipe up links in Stories and being able to report on that is hugely beneficial for a number of brands. So I definitely would say Instagram is kind of the number one platform. We still do a lot of YouTube work, and I would say that YouTube is definitely in that sort of longer term brand storytelling piece. You know, there's some things that you can get across in a YouTube video because you have that physical time and space to be able to really educate someone on something.
And people are often kind of looking for longer there.
Exactly. You know, whereas Instagram is that kind of quick, snackable content.
What are the metrics that brands want, you know, your clients, in terms of return on investment?
To be honest, it's very different depending on each brief. A lot of it is still brand awareness, which I think influencer marketing still has a really good place to play in. And everyone comes in with a very different opinion on how it should be measured. So we have a proprietary tool, which is owned by Group M, that we use, which is called Inca. And with that, what we actually do is guarantee based on cost per impression or cost per engagement. So we're actually able to guarantee those deliverables up front. So from a sort of more performance-driven angle, we've got a solution there that clients really love in terms of having that security that they know that they're going to get X amount of impressions going into a campaign. And then the other stuff that we do, which is slightly more creative, is more down that brand storytelling route. And with that, it's a combination of things. You know, sometimes we might look to add on like a brand uplift study, whether that's through an external partner or that's through our internal econometrics team.
Do you think with the kind of guaranteed impressions and engagements we're seeing kind of across the board that people are just creating bigger and bigger numbers and we've got a bit lost in sort of the vanity metric side of the space?
I think it serves a purpose when you're looking at that versus other media channels. You know, yeah. I think some clients really like knowing exactly what they're going to get going into it. And that's the risk. You know, sometimes clients think, oh, I don't know how many people are going to actually see this, or how many influencers I'm going to work with, or, you know, whatever it might be, or what's the actual reach, you know, because everyone knows that reach doesn't equate to total follower count. So I think it serves a purpose in terms of security and how many people are actually going to interact with that. But then I think the key thing is actually the upfront work, which is landing the right brief and also pairing that with the right influencers. And that's where our team come into it, where we can actually match the right influencers to the brief and the brand to make sure that it actually resonates with their audience. Because my opinion is, it doesn't matter how many people see it. What you want to actually know is if people are interacting with it and if people are acting upon that.
When you're creating a brief, what does that kind of look like? Is it sort of 4 pages, 5 pages? Is it overview? What, you know, when you're sending it to the influencer, what exactly you want them to do?
My opinion is that it should be the shorter the better. Not in the sense that it's so short that the influencer has free rein to go nuts, but, you know, these people are creatives. I think the mood board is the most important part, and giving them an actual visual understanding of what the brand is exactly looking for is really, really key. And then also having really tight brand guidelines in there. So we would call them do's and don'ts. I think that's the most important part. And I think in terms of a brief, anything longer than 2 pages is way too long, but we understand there are some brands and some clients where they might have a number of different terms that they have to put in there from a legal point of view, but we would make sure to highlight the key elements to the brief. And again, it depends on how we work with the influencers. You know, if we're activating multiple micro-influencers, then we might not necessarily take them through the brief in detail, but we would have the opportunity to vet the content before it goes live.
Would you be working with a platform in that instance, or would you be working?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then what about working with, say, bigger influencers? Do you do any of that direct, or does most of that happen with a manager? Are you more inclined to work with an influencer if they have management than without, for instance?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we have really good relationships with the talent managers. And
does that offer like a safety net to you? Would you prefer to work with a talent that has management?
Definitely. I would say it's a safety net, and also from an efficiency point of view. You know, often they have a group of influencers on their books, I hate to say it. But yeah, so for us, it's easier because we can go direct to them and say, hey, look, we've got this brief and this client, we're thinking X person, what are your thoughts? And they might say, oh no, actually this person would be really relevant for that campaign too. And we can potentially look to work with them on that. And I think we can only be in so many places at once. And to have people who are living and breathing with those influencers all the time, it helps to understand that kind of underlying sort of context behind it. And we work quite closely with them in bringing forward proactive opportunities to clients. So if an influencer's launching an IGTV series all around body confidence, you know, how can we start to take that to brands and start to get brands involved in that? So it kind of goes both ways.
Would you be less inclined to work with influencers that have talent management but is also part of an agency? So we're seeing now a lot of kind of lean influencer agencies launch talent divisions.
Mm.
So the agency side of it is a competitor to you, but they rep the talent. But if you go to the talent, then the talent management are going to know what briefs are out there and a bit more information about your clients, which might make the agency able to poach them. Thoughts?
It's a very difficult question.
You're on Serious Influence.
To be honest, I think it depends on the brief and the client. You know, we're quite good. So we don't work on like a retainer necessarily with clients. We work on more of a project by project basis, although we are starting to look at longer term partnership opportunities with some of our clients. And we're quite good in the sense that most Mediacom clients, especially the ones that we work with quite frequently, they're very open and transparent about where else they might be looking or what other options there are for them. So
what are your views on agencies launching talent divisions as well? Do you think that that gives kind of preferred treatment to their own talent?
A little bit, yeah. I think it's quite difficult and you can't be everything at once. And when I think of talent management companies who do it really well, you know, that's their specialism and that's their niche. And I think that's one of the key things that frightens me but worries me a bit about the industry is people trying to be the full 360 on their own, which just isn't sustainable.
Do you think that people are doing that just to try and get as much budget out of it as possible?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. But are you seeing budgets on the whole increase into the space? And even though they may be increasing, do you think they're being spread thinner?
Yeah, I've seen budgets increase massively. I think especially going from the tech side to agency, you just get access to bigger budgets.
Is that quite nice for you to be able to have a bit more to play with?
It's very nice, yeah. And it means that, you know, we can actually take a really holistic approach and test out different elements of influencer marketing and actually really understand what works for a client, because it won't always be like a one-size-fits-all solution. We're seeing bigger budgets come through, but they're asking them to be spread across a year or 6 months when sometimes that's not the best approach.
What does a planning cycle look like in Mediacom?
So
how many quarters ahead do you kind of work?
I mean, it really depends. We have some people who, you know, have been emailing me today about a brief for March, which scares me a little bit, but but is great. You know, the great thing about us is that we can be a bit more nimble. And although it's a little bit stressful, we can activate things quite quickly. And we're always willing to be flexible in that sense. But typically sort of 3 to 6 months is where we're usually looking at in terms of actually carving out a robust strategy and then actually taking it through to execution. But again, it all depends client by client.
I know that you've only been with Mediacom for just over 3 months, but in the kind of looking at your whole career, is there an influencer campaign that stands out to you as the best one that you've been involved with?
All that I've been involved with. Oh,
yeah. Well, okay. one that you have been involved with and one that you haven't been involved with.
Okay. I think there's a couple that, actually, there's quite a few. So ones that I have been involved with, there was a really interesting one at Tribe that was for Bacardi. And they ran this huge campaign around, it was your hashtag mojito moment. And it was basically people taking beautiful pictures of them and their friends drinking mojitos, which was great. And they ran an influencer campaign, which was around 70 influencers posting on socials. They licensed their favorite, I think it was around 20 to 25 assets, and actually pushed them out via digital billboards all across Australia. They put the influencer's handle on the actual asset as well, so it kind of looked similar to the shot on iPhone type example. And that was, you know, phenomenal. And I think it's clever planning and execution, and obviously you have to get in early enough to plan something like that, but it's a really clever way of actually taking influencers beyond organic social to a sort of 360 approach. And it was up for a number of awards, caught a lot of press, and I think the stat was around of a 14% sales uplift, which was great, because influencer marketing, as we all know, doesn't have those sorts of figures. We certainly don't have them being shared every day. So that was a really interesting campaign, just from a creative point of view. Some other stuff that was great at Tribe, we did a great always-on approach for Olay. So P&G were a big client of theirs, I'm assuming still are. And with Olay, it was great because we were basically able to be really nimble in our approach. So They had their kind of hero ambassadors that they were working with themselves through their agency. And then they also were running micro-activations kind of alongside that as a consistent always on. And they were really great at sort of quickly navigating and quickly adapting to different key moments. So all of a sudden, you know, it's going to be the hottest day of the year this weekend. How can we quickly activate some influencer content around that? And they were very good at tapping into those sort of key cultural moments,
yeah,
which really landed quite well. And when we did some analysis at the end of the year, I think it was around 20% of the influencers that had worked with them were actually the same people. So they almost had their own micro ambassadors alongside that, which was really cool to see.
With the Mojito kind of sales uplift and doing the out of home and the kind of billboards and display, would you, I think we've heard quite a lot that influencer isn't going to just be seen as one part, it's going to be part of bigger campaigns from the start now.
Mm.
How important are events and experiential and like using influencers not just on social in your plans?
Huge. Yeah, I mean, we probably didn't explain this at the beginning, but we sit within MBA, which is an internal content department within Mediacom. And we have a number of different disciplines from influencer to SEO. And we even have an experiential team. And we're collaborating with them on actually how can we start to run influencer events. So, you know, we're asked all the time to get influencers along to events. How can we start to actually own them ourselves as well? So we see that as being a really big part in taking things offline and IRL.
Yeah.
And it's obviously been working for some time. I think it's going to be a really big focus for a number of brands. And we've already had quite a number of briefs come through, whether that's getting influencers to an experiential activation that's potentially a bit bigger, or whether it's having an influencer event alongside that that sits within that. And I think
there's quite a lot of earned media value that happens through events as well. Is that something that's difficult to articulate to your clients?
Yeah, I think so. I think it depends on what the event is, to be honest, and who you've got attending. Some of them can be quite expensive from an outlay perspective. You know, so many brands that take influencers to Soho Farmhouse and that kind of stuff. And it's actually how do you start to quantify exactly what results you're going to get in return. But that's something that having a team like us being able to manage, as opposed to a more PR approach where we can sort of contract and actually start to be really robust about what we're going to deliver, that's hopefully going to help brands.
Do you work with media companies as well, sort of like the Hearsts, the News?
We often sit alongside them. So we work really closely with the content leads who basically work across a number of different disciplines, and they're almost like sort of new business in a sense, where they sit at the table with the client and uncover new opportunities and take these opportunities to clients. And often we work with them on either an influencer plus partnership opportunity or an influencer-led partnership. So it's something that we haven't actually run from in terms of like an execution perspective, but it's definitely something that we're looking at. The only thing to sort of note with that is a lot of them have their own talent that they often sort of factor into their proposals. So it's how does it sit alongside that to complement each other?
Yeah. Have you had any briefs where they want to work with virtual influencers? And what are your views on virtual influencers?
We actually haven't yet. So we haven't really had any.
Is this something that's actually going to take off, or is it just?
I'm in two minds. I think it's a really interesting concept. I haven't seen it really happen from an influencer perspective beyond a couple. I think some brands are doing some great stuff, like obviously KFC, have the Colonel. So it's interesting from a brand perspective. My only question is, from an influencer one, you know, how do we really have trust with a virtual influencer? You know, we don't know who they are. You know, it might be easier from a brand safety point of view.
There's still going to be a human behind a virtual influencer because it's a team building it.
Exactly, but we don't know who that is. Mm. And the person that you're resonating with on social, it's the real person behind it, you know, and that's the barrier that you've got. So although it's a cool concept, I'm not sure how well it will do in terms of actually delivering results. And there's already been some backlash like the Calvin Klein ad with Bella Hadid and Lil Michaela. There was a lot of backlash around that. So I'm interested to kind of watch and see. I'm interested to learn more, but we haven't had any clients come to us yet saying they want to work with them.
Yeah.
But I'm always keen to test out.
What are your biggest frustrations within the influencer marketing space?
It's getting better, but I think benchmarking in terms of price. And that's one of the most difficult conversations we have to have with clients sometimes. You know, they want to work with a Mrs. Hinch, who is amazing and delivers great results, but she's going to be way more expensive than someone else. And it's how do we benchmark what someone should be charging for what? And there's so many variables, you know, and ultimately it's how in demand someone is, because they only have a certain amount of social real estate, essentially.
Do you think sometimes clients are a bit surprised when influencers say no, that you can't just automatically buy what you want?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have a lot of people as well who don't quite understand the industry and the fact that you have to pay still.
Is that not very annoying?
I think the industry as a whole has such a varied level of experience and understanding, you know, which is great because, you know, from our perspective, we can still take clients on that journey and educate them. And that's our role in the mix. It's to be that.
Kind of forget how new it is to most people.
Yeah. And that's the difficulty. It's kind of gauging where people are at in that cycle. You know, we have some brands who have dedicated influencer teams in-house full-time who are working on this every single day, which is amazing. I mean, 5 years ago, that wouldn't have been the case. And then we have some brands who are just dipping their toe into working with influencers. So
is influencer taken seriously, like, within MediaCom? Because I know that, you know, you've got a big kind of legacy brand and you've got people that are high up the ladder that maybe, you know, in the same way that there's a lot of education, it hasn't been what they've been working on. It's a new thing. Are people quite quick to disregard it? And in that case, do you get enough power to sign the things off that you want to?
Well, it's definitely a mixed bag. I actually think sort of higher up in the agency, most people are really excited about influencers, and mostly because they read and they see about how quickly it's growing and, you know, how we can be a part of that, which is really exciting for us. I think there's obviously, you know, and that what I was talking about earlier in terms of people's knowledge and experience with influencers, that doesn't just sit with clients. That's, you know, people internally at our agency as well, because they're dedicated full time to working across other channels and they're not influencer experts, which is obviously the need for us as a department. So there's definitely that mix. And my role is just as much an internal sell as it is an external sell, and actually, if not more so internally, because we need to influence the right people internally in order to be able to get a seat at the table with clients to have those conversations. So it's definitely something that I'm constantly working through in terms of proving that influencer marketing works, proving that it should be a bigger part of media spend, and actually trying to get us involved a lot earlier and sooner. And there are some people who definitely see influencer marketing as sort of a bit on the side. So if there's some leftover budget, okay, let's just pop that towards influencers. And what I'm trying to do is basically influence internally so that they know exactly what we can deliver and the kind of stuff that we can do that's above and beyond traditional influencer marketing, so that we can start to get involved a lot earlier on. So things like out of home is a really big part of that.
Do you find sometimes that clients come to you and they've worked with maybe like lean influence agencies and been burnt? And if you could get rid of one part of the market to make your job easier, to be able to tell clients that working with influencers is beneficial, who would you get rid of?
I'm not going to say who. I know where you're getting.
Is there a layer though, like a type of person or a type of business that you think is actually, you know, because this is now a saturated market. So many people have come into it.
Mm.
And I think that there's also not enough communication between people. So everybody wants, you know, as you said, the one size, we can do absolutely everything, even though there is space in the market for people to do different things.
I think
over-promising, under-delivering.
Yeah, I think over-promising on deliverables and results. I know there are some agencies as well who sort of factor in paid spend, but maybe don't disclose it to basically boost the numbers that you're offering a client, but don't necessarily educate them on that. They just do it to win the business. So
is that fraudulent?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Is it? I think so. Mm. I think there's definitely a few cowboys that have cropped up, and that's a difficult thing. You know, there's so many companies coming into this space now. It's like, who does what, where? So you can understand from a client's perspective, they're just overwhelmed with the amount of offerings. And part of my role is to really understand these different offerings and who's good and who's not, and who we can actually take to clients. And that's a constant thing as well, because they're ever changing and developing. So I think there are some agencies that try and do absolutely everything, and they're also ripping, I wouldn't say ripping clients off necessarily, but there's a big part in ripping influencers off as well. And I think you need to be fair and transparent in all aspects, and you know, both in the amount that you're charging in your margins, and that's something we have to be super transparent about as a media agency. We have to justify our time and justify the work that we're doing. And, you know, for some platforms and agencies to come in and just swoop stuff off of us when they don't disclose that is quite frustrating sometimes. So I think there's that element to it, but also being fair and right to the influencers and fair and right to the brands as well.
Do you predict, and finally your predictions, that we will see more transparency moving forward? And what other things do you think that we'll see within the influencer marketing space?
I think transparency is a difficult one to predict from an agency and platform point of view. I think, you know, we've already seen a few people who were seen to be sort of key players in especially the London market, but the UK market sort of dwindle away quite quietly. So we'll definitely start to see more and more people either exiting or slowly sort of scaling back in terms of their resource. And I think, you know, given there's so many startups in this space, it's a difficult market, and you know, you need to be really watertight with how you manage and sustainably scale as a business. You know, there's a lot of young entrepreneurs, which I'm very supportive of and I think is great, but also, you know, you need to make sure that you're actually sustainably growing as a business for the long term, as opposed to just being here for a few years and then hoping to sell. And there's a lot of that.
I suppose that's not encouraged by the venture capital money that want to enter the market in 2015, because they want to see a 3 to 5 year exit.
Absolutely.
So it's about churning it around.
Absolutely. In terms of predictions, so, I mean, longer term partnerships have been a prediction for a while, but I definitely think we're starting to see them come into fruition a bit more this year.
And you're seeing more kind of retainers within your clients as well.
Absolutely. So they're looking at, okay, how do we sign this all off up front, as opposed to testing out each campaign and briefing a different partner every single time, you know, both from an efficiency point of view, but also just enabling us to be more agile in the way that we work.
Yeah.
And that's definitely something that we're seeing a lot more of. I think there's a really interesting evolvement of going beyond organic social. So I'm keen to stay close to Facebook's branded content ads and see what happens there. But the great thing about us as a media agency is we manage most clients' paid social budgets, which is great because we can work collaboratively to start to blend this organic and paid environment and start to test out what's really working there. So I think that will really help from a measurement perspective. And then finally, I think shopping and shoppable tags will be huge in the space, both from an influencer perspective, where you can actually start to now justify ROI and what's working. But also from a brand's perspective, if they're starting to take that content, which is resonating with consumers, and if they can generate that in a really time and cost efficient way, they now have this bank of content that they can use and now add that overlay of shoppable tags on top from their own perspective to more effectively reach consumers from their own channels, which I think is quite exciting.
A big thanks to Emily for coming on the show.
You've been listening to Blogosphere Serious Influence with me, Alice Audley. For more influencer industry updates, be sure to check out www.blogospheremagazine.com. And why not invest in a subscription to our essential magazine whilst you're there?